Here's Don Hollenbeck with the 6 o'clock news, a program presented by Peter Paul, makers of chocolate coconut mounds.
The news report tonight will emphasize that the war in Europe is very much on. I'll explain how those phony rumors of peace got started today and some of the commotion they caused. We'll try to bring you a report directly from the Western Front, subject always, of course, to the whims of atmospherics, with the latest word of the progress of 7 Allied armies, now reported far east of the Rhine, with the Germans broken into 4 segments and in utter rout. As General Eisenhower said today, the Germans as a military force on the Western Front are a whipped army, but that does not mean they cannot form a front somewhere where our maintenance is stretched to the limit and their defensive means can better be brought to bear. Full details after a word by Arthur Gary.
Is there someone in your family you pack a lunchbox for? A hard-working man in a war plant passed along this suggestion. He says, quote, "In my lunchbox, I like to have a bar of Peter Paul's Mounds. I eat it for dessert, or save it to eat when I'm hungry in the afternoon," end quote. For hard-working people, a bar of Mounds hits the spot most any time of day. Tree-ripened coconut, delicious chocolate. Mounds are not only a delight to taste, they're packed with energy-giving nourishment. Mounds, chocolate coconut Mounds. What a bar of candy for 5 cents.
Now for the story from the Western Front. American and British armies are crossing the plains of Middle Germany tonight almost unopposed. German resistance is demoralized at most points, and Allied divisions and armies are indulging in a race toward Berlin, 237 miles away. As General Eisenhower said, the Germans as a military force in the West seem to be whipped. For full details, we now take you to NBC in Paris.
Hello, NBC. This is Paul Archinard in Paris. It's not every day in the week that General Dwight Eisenhower comes to the press headquarters at Hotel Scribe in Paris. It's not even every week. When he comes, all your correspondents are on hand except those at the front, of course. And this is the case today when the Supreme Commander of the Allied armies walked into the lobby of the Hotel Scribe. Before going into the conference room, the General stopped to shake hands with the Sergeant of the 9th Army, Sergeant Junior Spurrier of Bluefield, West Virginia, who holds a Congressional Medal, several citations, the DSC, and the French Croix de Guerre. Then we all followed the Supreme Commander into the room, and standing with a background of gigantic war maps, he proceeded to let the war correspondents hear that the Germans are, as a military force on the Western Front, are a whipped army. General Eisenhower added, however, that this did not mean that a front could not be formed farther on, where our maintenance is stretched to the limit. There, defensive means can better be brought to bear, he said. The general gave us a pretty clear idea of what our maintenance is up against as the front draws farther and farther from its supply bases. For weeks, every available port has worked night and day. 55,000 tons of supplies were cleared daily during the month of February, and this in spite of the fact that our biggest and only undamaged port was constantly under V-bombings. Pipelines have been stretched across the continent, and thousands of miles of tracks have been restored. There'll be some darn tough fighting before it's over, said General Eisenhower. I know their main defensive line has been broken, he added, but that doesn't mean that all our difficulties are over. But in the General's opinion, there'll be no negotiated unconditional surrender. There'll be an imposed unconditional surrender. Meanwhile, there isn't going to be any desultory civilian sniping at our soldiers. Army commanders have orders to deal with civilian resistance sternly and on the spot. And, said General Eisenhower, I will not tolerate civilians out of uniform firing on my troops. This is Paul Archinard in Paris, returning you to the NBC newsroom in New York.
A partial censorship today naturally hides the exact movements of the triumphant Allied armies, but here are some of the day's reports, a few of them enemy admissions, of course. The greatest advance is reported by Berlin. A German broadcast today said Patton's 3rd Army columns are approaching Würzburg in Bavaria, 223 miles from Berlin, and had already reached Lohr, L-O-H-R, more than halfway across Germany toward Czechoslovakia. A Paris report says Patton's tanks are already threatening Nuremberg, nearly 100 miles beyond the point where Supreme Headquarters officially reports the 3rd Army. 3rd Army infantrymen are known to be fighting in the heart of Frankfurt, where at one point at least, German resistance is tough. Radio Luxembourg says Wiesbaden has been captured. One 3rd Army dispatch, heavily censored to take out all place names, says the advance is the greatest armored joyride in history, using Hitler's great 6-lane highways as roads to his own ruin. The 1st Army seems to have run completely wild. At the latest report censorship permits to get through, armored columns of the 1st Army have driven 22 miles beyond Limburg and are reported within 2 miles of Wetzlar, which is 30 miles due north of Frankfurt. 3rd and 1st Army columns have already joined hands solidly somewhere south of Koblenz, but that, of course, is far behind the spearheads of both armies. The 1st is driving for the Frankfurt-Berlin highway 13 miles away. But it's a different story on the American 9th Army front, where the Yanks are fighting into the Ruhr east of Wesel. Simpson's men were held for 15 hours and then made a 2 mile gain to within 2 miles of Dorsten. To the north, British 2nd Army forces are pushing ahead too. One dispatch says as though the enemy lines were made of butter. Absolutely no opposition there beyond Brünnen. At the southern end of the front, General Patch's 7th Army is expanding 2 crossings of the Rhine north of Mannheim, and a German report tonight says that Heidelberg, 12 miles south of Mannheim, is now under artillery fire. On the eastern front, the Russians contributed their share of one good heave altogether by breaking loose on a 350-mile front and capturing 2 important German positions. Strelen, 19 miles south of Breslau, and Ripnek in Poland, only 20 miles from Moravska Ostrava in Czechoslovakia's Moravian Gap. That's official from Moscow. The Germans say the Russians have already invaded Moravia and that the Soviet advance through Hungary has swept within 22 miles of Austria, that the Russians have reached the Raba River, which flows 60 miles from Vienna. The German communique also admitted the Russians have made new gains on the Berlin front and that one big armored concentration has reached Genschmar, which is 33 miles from Berlin and a little northwest of Küstrin. And Moscow's evening war bulletin just in says that Russian troops have now broken into the center of Danzig and that street fighting is underway in Gdynia. The fact that nothing gets around so quickly as false rumors was proved up to the hilt today with the inevitable exposure of the phony and the consequent hangover after a lot of nerve and telephone jangling. Along in the middle of the morning, Jonathan Daniels, the White House secretary, announced to a news conference that President Roosevelt on March 16th, 12 days ago, mind you, had asked that American officials, other than those named as delegates, remain away from the San Francisco conference. Such officials, the president felt, should remain on their jobs at this critical time. Quite a natural procedure, not at all hair-raising, you'd think. So what happened? One news service misinterpreted the story, and all kinds of phony peace rumors got going. Some radio stations, not NBC, hopped into the air with various elaborations, and so it went. Telephones to the White House, to police headquarters, to newspapers, and to radio stations rang continuously. Here at NBC, Maud Archer, our chief operator, said she's never seen anything like that 1 hour between 11 o'clock and noon when the truth finally won out. Nothing to the rumors. The war is still on, although it is going our way. But these things are only to be expected, I suppose, as Frank, who brings around the sandwiches, said this afternoon. People got edges on their nerves these days. In Germany, they really got edges on their nerves. Signs of the strain were plain today in a series of German broadcasts calling on all German troops to report at once to their units or to local authorities. These broadcasts explained, with some understatement, that many troops have lost contact with their outfits due to enemy action. In London, it was learned that during the past week there has been a sharp increase in the number of peace suggestions put out by so-called anti-Nazi Germans in neutral capitals. These should be disposed of course, by Eisenhower's flat statement today that there'll be no negotiated peace, but diplomatic officials, on the contrary, expect there'll be no let-up in them on the off chance that you never can tell, and there's always the hope of dividing the Allies. And that General Eisenhower statement today caused some flurries, too. The same news service which misinterpreted that presidential order flashed the news that Eisenhower had said the Germans were whipped. In Los Angeles, the word came quit, and the city council fell for it. You can imagine the to-do until the thing was straightened out. For that reason, General Eisenhower authorized a few direct quotations from his statement today. I recommend them as recommended reading in your morning paper in full. From the 1st Army front tonight come some stories that show the proportions of the German rout. The scene is past Limburg somewhere, and John McDermott of the United Press says that surrendering Germans are streaming along the highways all around Limburg, trying to find someone who has time to take them prisoner. American tank columns rattle by. Their crews survey the thousands of bewildered Germans. The crews merely jerk their thumbs toward the rear. No time to bother with prisoners now, with the whole German army in the west breaking up. And mingling with the hiking Germans are hundreds of liberated French, Russians, Belgians, and Poles. Their glee and gratitude is embarrassing. Others, too. Near Limburg, about 200 American and British prisoners of war set free by the Allied advance. Censorship hasn't yet released the names of these men, but there are some great reunions. For instance, Sergeant Frank Biffen of Garden City broke into a room where there was an American lieutenant, his name not given. The lieutenant sobbed. He said, "That can't be you, Sarge. It just can't be you." The lieutenant had been executive officer of Biffen's company before his capture last December in the Ardennes battle, when things looked a little different. And one more story that shows the extent of the German confusion. Our officers are having the same trouble Russian officers did during the days of the German collapse last winter. They can't get enough maps fast enough to keep up with themselves, and command post headquarters always look as if the paper hangers had just arrived. The maps are being put up or taken down from the walls so often. Out in the Pacific, Tokyo's report of American landings on Cebu in the Philippines remains unconfirmed by General MacArthur's headquarters, where the latest word is of a heavy air raid on Cebu, which is one of the three big islands still in Japanese hands. And Tokyo still insists that American forces are invading the Kurama Islands in the Ryukyu chain. This, too, without confirmation from our side. Officially, the only action in the Ryukyus is a continuing heavy air and sea bombardment from Kyushu for 1,000 miles southward to Formosa. There's one big story at home today. In Washington, the House passed the Compromise Manpower Bill, which applies stiff penalties to workers who quit their essential jobs and to employers who violate manpower ceilings. The bill streaked through by a 7-vote margin, 167 to 160, and the strength mustered against it surprised even its enemies. It now goes to the Senate, where it faces even rougher going. In this flashing kaleidoscope today, there's little opportunity to see individual pictures, but there ought to be room for the picture of Trudy, a 20-year-old German girl. Corporal Maxi Zira of the Bronx tells the story. Last Saturday, Company C of the 16th Infantry was having a tough fight for the town of Griesbach, then at the northern end of the 1st Army's bridgehead. Several Americans fighting near a farmhouse were wounded, and their comrades were too closely engaged to help them. Trudy was watching from a window, and she ran out to do what she could. Shell splinters flew around. In the midst of machine gun and rifle fire, Trudy bandaged those wounded men. When other GIs could get there, she helped them improvise litters. Then the Americans had to fall back briefly, and Trudy returned to the farmhouse. Several hours later, the Yanks took the place, and one of the first things they did was to look up Trudy. They found her badly wounded, her farmhouse burned down, shot on orders of a German officer who'd heard of her action. Today, she's in an American field hospital surrounded by gifts of fruit, candy, and cookies. And there'll be no fines for fraternizing with German civilians. And on this 27th of March, with General Eisenhower announcing that the main German defense line in the West has been broken, who do you think declared war on the Axis? News of that next. Now a word from Arthur Gary.
An officer in the Air Force writes, quote, "I have a bar of Mounds with lunch when I can get one. It certainly is a bright spot in the day," end quote. Yes, a candy bar can mean a lot to our men in the service. And what a lift they get when they bite into a bar of Peter Paul's Mounds. Tree-ripened coconut, delicious chocolate. Mounds are rich in energy, rich in nourishment, rich in pure eating enjoyment. Next time you ask for Peter Paul's Mounds, if the dealer happens to be out of them, think what pleasure that bar of Mounds you miss may be bringing to some boy in the service. Chocolate Coconut Mounds, M-O-U-N-D-S. What a bar of candy for 5 cents.
Argentina, it was, declared war on the Axis on this 27th of March, and the weather forecast is for fair and warm tonight and tomorrow, the temperature now 72. General Eisenhower says the German army on the Western Front is whipped. The Allied advances across the Rhine have cut the German armies into 4 segments. The Russians have broken into the center of Danzig. Keep tuned to NBC. We'll interrupt all programs for late developments.
Listen to Don Hollenbeck in the news every weekday evening at 6 o'clock. Today's program was presented by Peter Paul, makers of Chocolate Coconut Mounds.
This is the National Broadcasting Company.
This is Morgan Beatty speaking. We'll be back in a moment with news of the day. If you could do the thing most important to our servicemen and women overseas, I'm sure that you'd do it without hesitation. Well, you can do just that. Because to these people overseas, nothing is more important than mail from home. frequent, cheerful letters, fresh news about the friends and loved ones they've left behind. So we urge you to write often to your friends and relatives in distant lands. And we suggest that you write that letter by V-mail. V-mail is just right for short, frequent letters, and it takes up less space. And if you're worrying about the privacy of V-mail, speedy mechanical processing ensures privacy. These V-mail forms are easily obtained. They're on sale at most stores or can be obtained free at local post offices. Write V-mail. And now from Washington, here is Morgan Beatty.
As you may have heard, General Eisenhower has declared in Paris that the main German defense line in the West had been broken and that the enemy had suffered a defeat which he cannot afford. The Supreme Commander said he believes there will be no negotiated unconditional surrender of Germany, but rather an imposed unconditional surrender when the Allies in the West link up with the Russian armies in the East. For a direct report on this, a complete report on General Eisenhower's statement and other developments on the Western Front, the NBC will take you now to the NBC newsroom in Paris.
General Dwight Eisenhower made a special trip to headquarters today to give the war correspondents a fill-in on what's been going on along the Western Front. And after a long conference, he left little doubt that the preliminary phase of the battle against the Germans has been won, and decisively won, by Allied forces along the Rhine from Holland to Switzerland. Most of the things the Supreme Commander said were on the record, and a most detailed review of the entire plan. The major part of this plan was to destroy the German forces west of the Rhine. And the general remarked, in this connection, that this did not mean shooting every Nazi soldier or destroying every bit of German equipment, but rather that it meant a complete dislocation of German defensive positions, which has now been accomplished. And he told in more detail than I can remember. Every single American force anywhere along the Rhine was instructed for every opportunity to get across by a bridge if there was one, by boats if there were any available, and lacking all else, to swim across. And so, starting from north to south, this recent offensive has been a series of tremendous shocks to the enemy, because the Germans never knew where we were going to strike at them, and in a lot of places they never found out until too late. General Eisenhower told us that he wasn't writing this war off as yet, because even with the tremendous defeat which has been handed out, these Nazi enemies of ours still seem inclined to stand up and fight until the situation is so hopeless that there's nothing left for them but surrender. And he acknowledged that it's barely possible that they may be able to establish another defense line somewhere east of the Rhine, but it would be without their great industrial regions, such as the Ruhr and the Saar, where our troops are running wild right now. The general said that he was firm in his belief that all civilian resistance must cease at once in the occupied areas, and that order will be established by force of arms until such time as the general unconditional surrender terms can be formulated by the Allied governments. He was lavish in his praise of ground, air, and sea forces cooperating in the joint offensive, and he lauded his supply service and his own commanders. And he did not, let me repeat, he did not make a prediction as to how soon the war will end. All in all, with the recent news of the advance of the 2nd British Army in the north and the breakthrough by General Patton's troops to the vicinity of Weilburg, another 11 miles northeast of Limburg, and with the 7th American Army reported in an extremely favorable position, there are a lot of smiles here at headquarters tonight. This is Roy Porter in Paris, returning you to Morgan Beatty in Washington.
Thank you, Roy. As a result of reports like we've just heard from Roy Porter in Paris, it's natural that in the Allied nations, reports are spreading like wildfire today. Argentina has finally decided to get on the bandwagon. She's declared war on the Axis. Here in Washington, the president ordered our diplomats in Europe and his cabinet officers here in Washington as well to stand by their posts. Presumably, he wishes to avoid a transatlantic traffic jam in preparation for the San Francisco World Conference. He may well have other crises in mind, too, such as the crisis in Germany at this moment. Anyway, this report about our official standing by received a neat bit of embroidery in at least one news dispatch, indicating our officials are standing by for the end of the war in Europe. Radio stations all over the country are being flooded with calls. Listeners take this report to mean many different things, apparently. Mostly, they take it to mean what they want to hear, that the end of the war in Europe is at hand. But you've heard the warning of General Eisenhower. He has not written this war in Europe off as yet. The thing we should keep to the forefront of our minds at this time is that the jitters are natural, civilian jitters, and normal things. They're normal things for people to have at this moment, as long as they don't interfere with the war itself. But above all, we should keep our eyes on the military ball and on the military maps, the one Roy Porter was talking about a moment ago. The Germans continue to keep their right wing strong on the west. The great Russian assault against the German armies in the Berlin zone hasn't started yet. On the other end of the battle line, in the east and in the west, even in the center in the west, developments are entirely different. The picture is as different as day and night. We must note this difference in the northern fronts and the southern ends of these two fronts. The southern end of the battle line in the west has collapsed on the German side. That's what we're getting so many reports about today. Our soldiers are riding tanks into German towns. Now, when soldiers ride tanks, it means they've been ordered to the front rapidly because there is no resistance in the front zones. General Patton and his men have spearheaded eastward, at least to Lohr in Bavaria, and Roy Porter even carried them further than that. They're about 100 miles west of the borders of old Czechoslovakia, only 200 miles from Prague, the capital of that state in pre-war days. In short, General Patton has entered into the south-central German plains, and his tanks are on the loose. The American First Army, just to the north of Patton, is making the same kind of progress, although not quite as fast. First Army tanks have burst into Weilburg, as he reported, 244 miles southwest of Berlin in the center. But to the north, as we've noted, the story is different. The British Second Army and the Canadian First Army are running into great and serious opposition. We'll go into the reasons why in just a few moments. Now, your announcer, I'll be back in exactly 60 seconds.
Paper packs a punch. Just how, you ask? Well, paper is used in the manufacture of many vital war supplies. It goes into containers and cartons for food, weapons, and equipment needed by our armed forces. What's more, it goes into the actual weapons of war. Weapons such as incendiary bombs, bomb fins, wingtips, airplane signals, parachute flares, ration containers, and ammunition carriers. So you can easily see that much of our paper goes overseas, and this is paper that will never return. And as our attack broadens, more and more paper will be used. But there's a shortage of paper at home. Increased production? Oh, no, we can't do that. There's a manpower shortage. The main way in which we can keep the paper mills at work producing for war is by each one of us, you and me, saving every scrap of paper. Yes, every scrap, no matter how small. And get in touch with your local salvage committee. Remember, paper packs a war punch. Save it. And now, once again from Washington, here is Morgan Beatty.
In addition to what Roy Porter told us from Paris a few moments ago, General Eisenhower says that while the German army is a whipped army, that does not mean the enemy cannot form a new front at a point where our maintenance problems become an obstacle to us. He emphasized that the Allies still have tough fighting ahead, particularly in the north, the area I have just mentioned before the break. By sheer coincidence, in today's mail, I have a letter from Richard Pallant of Station KANS in Wichita. He says the failure of the Germans to evacuate Holland south of the Zuider Zee leads one to wonder if that is not a part of the death stand policy of holding key ports such as Bordeaux, Saint-Nazaire, and so forth. On the other hand, says Mr. Pallant, the failure of the Allies to make any major effort to gain control of the most important part of the whole Rhine River, its mouth, seems puzzling. Puzzling, he adds, inasmuch as the possession of just Antwerp has reputedly made possible our great drive to the Rhine in the north. If Antwerp is that pivotal, he goes on, how much more so would be the command of the Rhine mouth ports and water access to our supply ships to the heart of industrial Germany? Mr. Pallant calls for discussion, and now's the time for it. For a landlubber in the heart of the nation, a long way from salt water, that's as straight thinking as I've ever come across. I've asked our military expert that same question many times. Already today, I have given part of the answer, so has General Eisenhower. As a matter of fact, he gave it long before I did. Allied offensives must first roll across the great water gap, the Atlantic Ocean and the English Channel. The Germans, both in the west and to the east, we must remember, going back, made a suicide stand in all the ports of importance to the north. Cherbourg, Dunkirk, Antwerp, and so on. The question for our high command some time ago was how much Allied energy should be diverted to reducing these ports and making them useful for the offensives that were to come, the offensives that are now rolling. It was decided many months ago to gain only two of these ports, Cherbourg and Antwerp. Both ports were won at great cost. And as I've noted before, the Germans struck back at the very moment we were ready to use Antwerp for a major offensive in December of last year. Meanwhile, it was discovered that the south of France had not been well defended. Destruction had not been carried out on a large scale. Hence, a sudden alteration of plans, and the drive up through France by the American 7th Army, and another vastly important supply line, complete with ports facilities in southern France, was added to the Allied assets in Europe. But that line took ships as well as the line through Cherbourg and Antwerp. The next step was to destroy the German armies west of the Rhine in the fixed positions of the Siegfried Line. We dared not leave that bristling fortress in the rear to threaten our supply lines. As you've heard on this program, General Eisenhower's armies have just completed that step. They have broken the German line. The general is careful not to say the German armies have yet been defeated. We have merely won another battle, and we're going into the third and the final one, the defeat, the final defeat of German resistance. As we go into that final battle, to answer Mr. Pallant's final query, we do need either Rhine River bridges or a port. But wouldn't it be better to have a port if we go after one north of the Rhine, beyond the line we have just broken? The military men say the answer is yes. It's too bad that the army generals and planners can't stop every few moments to explain to us what they're doing, what their mistakes are, and what they've accomplished. But they can't. They can only stop at critical points like today. They can't stop any more, and as a general rule, then we can stop to explain to them better ways to gain complete cooperation on the home front and so on. Talk, you know, in the heat of a great war or a battle in that war is valuable only so long as talk does not interrupt the speed of battle. But talk often stirs up rumors and misunderstandings. The Army issued a letter today from General Patton, whose tanks are now rampaging through Germany at a terrific speed. Speed has been the demand of Patton in tanks. The reasons should now be apparent to everybody. The Army chose a good moment to make public his appraisal of our tanks. Anyway, here's what he says in part. It has come to my knowledge, says General Patton, that certain misguided or perhaps deliberately mendacious individuals returning from the theater of war have criticized the equipment of the American soldier. I've been in command of fighting units since the 7th of November, 1942, and may therefore claim to some knowledge of the various types of equipment. With reference to the tank, either Mark V light or Mark IV medium, it has been stated at home that these tanks are not comparable with the German Mark IV, the so-called Panther and Tiger type tanks. This statement is wholly incorrect, says General Patton, for several reasons. And then the general goes on to explain that we want speed. The Germans want a slow tank that they can dig in and shoot at us as we come at them. General Patton hadn't had speed, as he explains in his letter today, he would never have been able to cross the Rhine, and if he had crossed it, he would never have been able to make the speed he's now making in the forward zones. And what's more, he explains, remember, ships are limited in the number of tanks of high tonnage they can carry. That's all for now, and thank you. I'll be back at this same time tomorrow.
Today, there are over 5 million servicemen overseas. That's 2 million more than there were at this time last year. More men overseas means that more tons of vital supplies for each man must be carried over European and Pacific supply lines that grow longer each week. Mail represents a tremendous part of this burden of supply. But we're not saying that you shouldn't write to the men overseas. On the contrary, one of the most important things is that they receive frequent letters from friends and relatives back home. But we suggest that when you write, write V-mail. V-mail takes less valuable space. 1,000 regular letters weigh 22 pounds. 1,000 V-mail letters weigh 4 ounces. See the difference? So when you write, write V-mail. Morgan Beatty is heard Monday through Friday. Tomorrow at the same time, keep up with the news with Morgan Beatty. And keep tuned to your NBC station for the latest news. This is the National Broadcasting Company.